Good evening, everyone, and welcome to ONA's Bill 124 Court Decision Town Hall. My name is Bernie Robinson. I am your interim president and Region 2 vice president with the Portfolio of Education. Joining me today on this call are Angela Priocannon, ONA's first vice president with the Portfolio of Professional Practice and Political Action, Don Armstrong, Region 1 vice president, Portfolio of Human Rights and Equity, Karen Mackay-Eden, Region 3 Vice President with the Portfolio of Labor Relations, Aaron Aris, Region 4 Vice President, Portfolio of Local Finance, and Alan Warrington, Region 5 Vice President, Portfolio of Health and Safety. We are also joined by our senior staff, Andrea Kay, Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Lobsinger, Chief Negotiator, Sharon Bazran, our Chief Legal Officer and Legal Counsel, along with Lawrence Walter, Executive Lead Communications and Government Relations. I'd like to thank you for taking the time to join us on this call to hear about the decision on ONA's Bill 124 Charter Court case that was released on November 29, 2022. I encourage you to inform your bargaining unit members and colleagues about tonight's town hall. This is being recorded and we will be posted on our website for those who are not able to listen in tonight. I'm going to take just a minute or so to review the agenda for the town hall. In a few moments, Angela, our first VP, will provide some details and run a short survey that you will be able to join in on. I'll give some opening comments and then Sharon will introduce our legal team, who will provide us with an overview of the decision in ONA's court case on Bill 124. After this, Stephen Lobsinger, our chief negotiator, will update us on upcoming negotiations. We will then take your questions. So for now, I'm going to turn it over to Ange.
Thanks, Bernie. Good evening, everyone. So in the meantime, we are in the process of calling all our ONA members to connect them to this town hall. It will take several minutes to contact as many people, so please give us a few more minutes and then we will start when everyone is online. During the town hall, you can ask a question at any time by pressing *3 on your telephone. You will be briefly taken out of the meeting to talk to an operator. They will take your name, workplace, and your question, and then you will be returned to the meeting. If you have a technical issue or need to leave and come back later, you can do so by calling this number, 1-855-859-7245. Again, that phone number is 1-855-859-7245. This technology also allows us to ask you some questions, and you can respond by pressing a key on your telephone. So let's give this a try. Our first question for today is one that we're hopeful we get a huge percentage. Right now we have about 4,000 people on the phone. And so the first question is, do you feel you and your colleagues have a willingness to take political action to protest if the government appeals the court's decision that Bill 124 is unconstitutional? Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. So again, the question is, do you feel that you and your colleagues have a willingness to take political action to protest if the government appeals the court's decision that Bill 124 is unconstitutional? So I'll give you a couple minutes to get going there. Wow, great results so far. 85% of you are saying you're going to do it. So this is really great. Numbers are climbing still. Oh my. The tension is mounting. 86% have a willingness to go out on political action and protest. Well, that's really great to hear. So while we finish up with this result, I'm going to start the next poll question shortly. And this next question is, three options. Given the current environment for nursing, do you intend on staying in nursing leave the profession, or unsure. So yes, stay in nursing, press 1. No, leave the profession, press 2. And unsure, press 3. Pretty hopeful so far. So again, the question is, given the current environment for nursing, do you intend on staying? Press 1. Leaving the profession? Press 2. Or unsure? Press 3. So right now the results show 39% are staying in nursing. 22% are leaving. And 39% are unsure. So we have one more question to ask. And I'll just wait for that to come up on the screen. And the question is, have you signed up to our newest platform, Access ONA? 1 for yes, press 2 for no. So Access ONA is the platform that we have that has your email address and your telephone number updates so that we can contact you. Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. Just getting a few more responses here before I give you the results. And it looks like the 48% of you have signed up to Access ONA. Unfortunately, 52% of you have not. So Bernie will speak to this later on. So thank you very much for answering those questions, and I'm going to turn this back over to Bernie.
Great. Thank you, Ange. Thanks, everybody, for participating in that. So our fight against Bill 124 has been going on now for more than 3 years. It was passed in 2019. We knew from the beginning that this legislation was unfair. It targeted female-dominated professions, and it interfered with our right to collectively bargain. Immediately, when the Ford government rammed through this disaster of a bill, ONA began to put our charter challenge together to prove that Bill 124 was unconstitutional. Our amazing legal team, who you're going to hear from tonight, put together a strong case of affidavits, case law, and thousands of pages of evidence. It was presented in court. We are thrilled to report that ONA and other public sector unions have won a landmark victory, striking down Bill 124 as a violation of their constitutional rights of public sector workers. Today, we are pleased to provide you with a short summary of the legal decision. This decision comes after a long 3-year battle. It's been fought in the courts, in our communities, and in the streets. Our members have been integral in this fight, and we will continue to be so until we achieve the fairness and justice everyone deserves. I'm very pleased to host this town hall this evening with our Chief Legal Officer and Legal Counsel, Sharon Bazran, and our legal team, who will now walk us through the court's decision and next steps. So Sharon, over to you.
Thanks, Bernie. Good evening, everyone. So it's really exciting on behalf of the legal team to spend this time with you to explain the decision and to introduce our legal team. As Bernie mentioned, ONA came out of the gate and immediately filed our charter application a month after this legislation was introduced, and we filed it in mid-December of 2019. Since that time, our legal team has worked incredibly hard to put together a significant amount of evidence from frontline members to local leaders to provincial leaders, and also we called a number of experts. And all of that evidence was called before we actually made it to court. So I'm pleased that our legal team will describe some of that evidence for you. We were in court from September 12th to 23rd, and the decision was actually released for a court quite quickly, only 2 months later on November 29th. So it is a long decision. It's 81 pages, but there are a couple of paragraphs because I always like to jump to the conclusion. So at the end of the day, Justice Conan, who was the judge appointed in this case, declared that Bill 124 violated Section 2D of the Charter of Rights and Freedom. And that's the section that guarantees what's called the right to freedom of association, which includes the right to engage in meaningful collective bargaining on your behalf. The legislation was declared void and has no effect. So I'm going to turn it over to our legal team, who is Kate Hughes, who's not able to join us tonight, but we're pleased to be joined by Jan Borroway and Danielle Bisnar, who worked together to make all of these legal arguments on your behalf. And having watched them in court, they really did make huge efforts on your behalf to come up with a number of great legal arguments, which we'll now hear from. So Danielle, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Sharon, and good evening, everyone. So I'm going to speak for a bit to give you an overview of the judge's findings, and then Jan will highlight how some of Ona's evidence was really critical to many of those important conclusions. So the decision arose or was the result of a legal challenge to what we've been calling Bill 124, but its official name was the Protecting Sustainable Public Services for Future Generations Act. The effect of the bill was to limit compensation increases for 3 years of three collective agreement years to a maximum of 1%, and it applied to all publicly funded healthcare settings and over 90% of ONA members. ONA was actually the first union to immediately file a charter challenge after the bill was passed in November of 2019. So as Sharon said, ONA filed its application in December of 2019. And ONA made two main arguments. One was that the bill and its limit or its compensation cap of 1% violated Section 2D of the charter, which is the guarantee to freedom of association. And it's under this element of the charter that the Supreme Court of Canada has recognized that the right to meaningful collective bargaining is protected. And when the Supreme Court recognized that protection for collective bargaining, it held that the purpose of doing that was to address what it recognizes the fundamental inequality between workers and employers, and to help provide approximate equality of bargaining power through recognizing the protection of collective bargaining under that section. So under Section 2D, ONA argued that the 1% compensation cap violated ONA's 2D rights by substantially interfering with the right to meaningful collective bargaining. And it did this by taking a fundamental term of employment compensation off the bargaining table. And by doing that, it gutted ONA's bargaining power. And this was particularly significant at a time when ONA's members would have otherwise had significantly increased bargaining power due to the chronic need for nurses and long-term staffing shortages, which were then exacerbated by the pandemic. So Justice Conan overwhelmingly agreed with ONA's arguments and the other unions' arguments on Section 2D, and he delivered nuanced, detailed reasons recognizing many harms that flowed from Bill 124. These harms included that it economically harmed workers by restricting unions' ability to negotiate compensation increases. It weakened unions' bargaining power and prevented unions from trading off higher wage increases for other non-monetary benefits or priorities in bargaining. And the government used its legislative powers to tilt the balance of power in favor of the government and in favor of employers, thereby eradicating the bargaining power that would normally accompany a labor shortage. He also recognized that that the ability of employees to identify and pursue their own collective goals was harmed by the bill. He specifically mentioned that Bill 124 prevented ONA from advancing its identified bargaining priorities that were identified through its bargaining process of staffing ratios and job security, because with only 1% available, there was nothing that ONA could trade off or use to negotiate for those priorities. He also importantly recognized that Bill 124 damaged not only the union's position with respect to employers, but also harmed ONA's relationship with its own members. He recognized that the frustration, members' legitimate frustration with ineffective representation was turned towards ONA when it was in fact the government that had suppressed effective bargaining by limiting what could be negotiated. Justice Conan also recognized that Bill 124 prevented unions and employers from working together to find solutions to address long-term recruitment and retention crises in the healthcare sector and the impact of short staffing on remaining workers that was both chronic and greatly increased by the effects of the COVID pandemic. He also recognized that Bill 124 prevented unions from choosing who bargains together and that it disrupted longstanding bargaining relationships and patterns in the long-term care sector, where charitable and for-profit homes have historically bargained together, and that this resulted in increasing wage disparities between municipal and for-profit nursing homes. And finally, he recognized a number of ways in which Bill 124 interfered with free collective bargaining and with the statutory powers of interest arbitrators. He found that under Bill 124, the government had overridden 6 collective agreements that were freely negotiated between ONA and employers. He found that Bill 124 interfered with the independence of interest arbitrators who, under the Hospital Labor Disputes Arbitration Act, are tasked with replicating the results of free collective bargaining through interest arbitration decisions for workers like the vast majority of nurses who do not have the right to strike. And for those employees who do have the right to strike, he found that Bill 124 effectively deprived them of a real right to strike by removing their ability to strike over compensation. So you'll see from that long list of ways in which he recognized that Bill 124 negatively impacted workers and their right to collective bargaining, that he engaged in a careful analysis and recognition of many harms caused by the bill. In our assessment, his reasoning is nuanced. It's sensitive to the fundamental purpose of Section 2D and the right to collective bargaining, which is to address the fundamental inequality of bargaining power between workers and employers. Because he made so many findings of different kinds of harms, there are a number of redundancies built into his reasons. And for all of these reasons, we feel that it's a strong decision that we're confident about defending in any potential appeal. And so on the basis of his reasons on Section 2D, he held that Bill 124 is of no force and effect as of November 29th. So the other area in which the other argument that ONA advanced was an argument under Section 15 of the Charter, which is the provision of the Charter that is a guarantee of equality on the basis of protected grounds. And so in this case, ONA argued that Bill 124 discriminated against predominantly women healthcare workers who are engaged in what has historically been viewed as women's work. Nearly 80% of the workers covered by Bill 124 are women identifying and work in the predominantly and historically female sectors such as healthcare and education. So ONA argued that Bill 124 reinforced the undervaluing of traditionally women's work and reinforced the gender pay gap by suppressing wages in these predominantly female sectors. While the court did not uphold this argument, the evidence that we introduced in support of this argument did have an impact on the Section 2D analysis. Justice Conan accepted all of ONA's evidence with respect to the gendered nature of the labor market and the historic devaluing of women's work. He accepted the evidence of Dr. Pat Armstrong, who was the expert that the union's advancing equality arguments relied on with respect to the nature of the healthcare labor market and the role of gender in the healthcare labor market. He also accepted the evidence of ONA leadership and members regarding nursing demographics and their own experiences of gendered career streaming. And this all informed the court's analysis of how Bill 124 interfered with collective bargaining by exacerbating the power imbalance between employers and workers. That is just one of the many ways in which ONA's evidence was critical to the court's finding. I'm going to pass it on to Jan now to highlight some of the other ways in which the experiences of ONA's members and leadership were key to arguments that we were able to advance and the court's findings on the harms of Bill 124.
Great. Thanks, Danielle and Sharon, and good evening, everyone. So what I wanted to do was first shine a spotlight on ONA's very important evidence before the judge. Because it played such a critical role in the finding that Bill 124 breached your charter rights. And then next I want to turn to some of his analysis about what we call Section 1, which is this balancing of charter rights with does the government have a legitimate argument for introducing a piece of legislation that violates rights. So let's turn to the spotlight on ONA's evidence. So as Sharon said, you know, ONA filed a massive, massive record, a massive amount of evidence. We had affidavits from bargaining unit presidents, from provincial leaders, CEO and president. We filed thousands of documents, including ONA's interest arbitration briefs, which have been before interest arbitrators. And each of those, as many of you will know, include significant statistical analysis and overview of the situation of nursing. All of that made a huge and significant difference. And in fact, the justice said that he had no doubt, based on the evidence, that it easily demonstrated that Bill 124 substantially interfered with your charter rights. So one of the key areas he looked at, which I know is so important for nurses, is that obviously he agreed that the act coincided with this serious staffing, recruitment, and retention issues in healthcare, particularly in long-term care and hospital sectors. He then turned to look at, well, what did that mean? And ONA made oral arguments on this, and we had enormous amount of documentary evidence around the short staffing within hospitals and long-term care and all of the sectors in which ONA represents nurses. And he said, look at the shortages, the short staffing mean that existing staff have to work even harder on a given shift than they normally would do. And they're doing so for no extra pay, and certainly in the context of Bill 124, no extra pay. That has a serious, and takes this short staffing takes a serious toll on the mental and physical health of employees. It means increased workload, and it also means, as a result, more injuries, and it put a huge burden, particularly in long-term care, on the staff. And he then demonstrated and accepted the evidence that so many frontline nurses know and have talked about through much of your campaigning with ONA, that you actually have this stark, stark emotional choice. You have to work with a dying patient that you have no time for, and meanwhile knowing that you're denying other patients their basic needs. And he said, look, it, I recognize, and he accepted the evidence that when confronted with that type of choice, and you're living that those kind of choices, out day by day. You break down in tears. You're exhausted and you're burned out. And he called it he termed it a vicious cycle of short staffing. And Bill 124 contributed to that. His next comments were essentially that he looked at, and Danielle's mentioned this, at the impact of on specific bargaining, and that again, ONA had very specific priorities heading into bargaining. When ONA sought on the hospital sector an adjustment of full-time and part-time staffing ratios, in longstanding, there were certain expert recommendations that supported ONA's position, and they also sought changes to job security language and improvements. Well, the Ontario Hospital Association declined to accommodate those kind of important priorities because they said they couldn't do so under Bill 124. And as Danielle and Sharon have mentioned, the arbitrators themselves commented on this. In one of the hospital decisions, the arbitrator said, look, I would have, as a matter of course, given the nurses the going rate at 1.75%, but I'm constrained by Bill 124. Other arbitrators said our hands are tied and Bill 124 just puts us into a straitjacket. Now, what was interesting is that the justice also commented on the fact that in this context of bargaining, HILDA actually does provide, a very important criteria, which is for interest arbitrators to think about and look at ways to attract and retain qualified employees. And he noted that in any other time, and this is part of ONA's work on their cross-examination of the expert out of the government, he said, at any other time when you've got a labor shortage, that would have translated into increased wages. And in fact, under Bill 124, that didn't happen. So that is substantial interference. He also, and Danielle's mentioned this, and I'll just say this briefly, he really focused in on ONA's evidence of how the Treasury Board had the ability under 124 to override collective agreements. And ONA's evidence was that had happened with six collective agreements, which meant that you as nurses could not, and other healthcare employees could not get what you in fact had bargained for, and your collective agreements were overridden and that interfered. And let me just finally say, and Danielle's mentioned this, so I won't go on in it because we want to get to your questions, that he was very concerned about the impact of the relationship between the unions and their members, and ONA led very important evidence on that. So ONA, again, had a significant impact in the decision. It set helped to set the context in which Bill 124 was functioning. So where does that take us? Is that the end of the story and the analysis? And in fact, it's not, because when a justice looks at our charter guarantees, our rights and freedoms, those are not absolute. A balancing, what often gets called is balancing happens, and that's because within the charter there's a section called section one, says that these charter rights as set out can only are subject to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. So what does that mean? Well, the ultimate question is that the charter infringement has to be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. And it's up to the government to show that the infringement was justified. So there's a number of tests that that are required in that kind of analysis. And it's this balancing of the objectives of Bill 124 that obviously infringed your charter rights. And is that justified in a free and democratic society? This justice found no, it's not. And he did so in a number of ways, but a couple I just want to highlight really quickly. So one of the ways he said it's not truly justified is that on one hand, the government said, look at, we're going to save a lot of money from Bill 124. We're going to save $400 million a year. Well, just at the time Bill 124 was introduced, the government then eliminated $1 billion per year in revenue from, as everybody knows, the license plate sticker situation, where all of the monies were refunded if you paid for your license plate stickers in 2020 to 2022. So just at the same time they're limiting your wages, the government decides to eliminate a way to create more revenue. So the justice says, well, Ontario has not, and I'm quoting from the decision, however, explained why it was necessary to infringe on constitutional rights to impose wage constraints at a time it was providing tax cuts or license plate sticker refunds that were more than 10 times larger than the savings obtained from the wage restraint measures. That influenced his decision on why this was not justified. He then turned to look at, importantly, the long-term care sector. And he actually drilled down to review how the funding happens within the long-term care sector. And he said, look, there's no rational connection between this objective of wage restraint and really how the funding works. If anything, that so-called connection is at best remote. And so when he looked at this, he, as I say, drilled down and he looked at how the funding occurs and that there could have been modifications made on the daily patient fee to help pay long-term care homes. And he says, interestingly, that in fact, the province is not actually directly controlling wages in long-term care because they actually pay monies that go into long-term care are based on the daily patient fee. So he concludes that the fact that it might be more politically convenient to infringe a charter right rather than refuse additional funding to long-term care homes doesn't justify the infringement. If political convenience were the test, it'd be far too easy to infringe on charter rights on a regular basis. So finally, just let me say that he concludes with a number of, I think, critical pieces. He says, look, if governments are permitted to infringe on charter rights in times of relative growth and prosperity, in the absence of an imminent or present fiscal urgency without explaining the need to breach charter rights or the need to pursue inconsistent policies, it's far too easy for governments to infringe charter rights. And so in doing so, he said, look, it's not appropriate unless there's a very serious fiscal challenge. It's not appropriate to infringe charter rights just for the day-to-day management of government affairs. And in that light, he says, there was no justification. There was no rational basis to justify infringing your charter rights. And so in that regard, it's a very strong decision because it's based on facts. It's based on, as Danielle said, the facts and the context, which makes it a very high-quality decision. And his reasoning through the analysis of what the alleged balancing was, given the government's objective of fiscal restraint, he says doesn't add up. And that, too, was very strong, which will assist if any appeal goes forward. So I think, Danielle, it's over to you for any final comments you want to make.
Thanks. Just very briefly, I want to touch on what we anticipate the next steps will be with the legal challenge. Many of you may have heard in the media that Ontario has made statements and Premier Ford has made statements about the government's intent to appeal this decision. As Jan and I have both said, we think that this is a very defensible and strong decision, but those statements remain only media statements at this point. We do not have official notice through counsel of the government's intent to appeal. If it does, in fact, proceed with appeal, it needs an appeal. It needs to do that by the end of December. And then finally, I just want to acknowledge that as As Sharon mentioned, Kate Hughes is unable to be with us tonight, but I just wanted to close by honoring her. The reason that she's unable to be here tonight, and she does send her regrets and greetings and congratulations to you all, but the reason that she's not here is that she is embarking on retirement after 35 years of advocating for nurses, and she has been a fierce and skilled advocate for nurses in many venues and a passionate fighter for workers. And so we just wanted to acknowledge her role in this victory as well. So I'll pass it back to Bernie for the next item. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Danielle and Jan. That was amazing. So before we move on, I'd like to remind you that you can ask questions by pressing *3 to get in the queue. I'd like to now call on Steve Lobsinger, our chief negotiator, to talk about next steps in bargaining.
Thanks, Bernie. Good evening, everyone. And thank you to the legal team that has done such a great job in getting us to where we are. Now this is where we hit the ground running, or rubber hits the road, I guess, on what we do next. Since the court decision means that Bill 124 has no effect or had no effect, we will be able to go back to the table to renegotiate issues relating to total compensation that we were constrained by Bill 124, like the 1% wage cap, among other monetary improvements. We've had preliminary discussions with the lead negotiators for the OHA representing the hospitals, the lead negotiators representing the participating nursing homes, and for the Human Community Care Coordination Support Services about what, in their view, does this look like. The OHA has told us that they have to go back to their board and get a new mandate for bargaining for those years. So the exact plan of what it looks like are yet to be determined, but we will be proceeding in any event. Towards the end of last week, we served notice on arbitrators Stout, Gedeloff, and Goodfellow, indicating that ONA was seeking to activate the reopener clauses in the arbitration decisions for the participating hospitals, participating nursing homes, and Monchong Home for the Aged. This week, we're continuing to serve notice on arbitrators for other non-participating groups, homes for the aged, etc., the charitable homes that were covered by 124, as well as we will be providing notice to individual employers where we got settlements with reopeners that we intend to come back to the table to renegotiate anywhere where 124 applied. So if the central parties aren't able to resolve their compensation issues, then we then are able to go back in front of the arbitrators that we were in front of before to get an arbitrated decision. We believe that the reopener in the right to strike sector, we think it gives you back your right to strike. We're not sure. We'd love to check further on that, but so we'll have to stay tuned on that one. And for any who settled but would be under the HILDA sector, then you should be able to proceed to conciliation and arbitration if you're unable to settle your collective agreements. It's expected to go first with the participating hospitals, seeing as we have negotiations set up for the renewal starting in the end of January. It would be nice to know our starting point. So we'd like to get those done first and then have the others follow. For home care coordination and support services, we've sort of hit the reset button. We had started bargaining with four groups, those being Central East, Central, H&HB, and Waterloo Wellington. We had done days of negotiation and were in the process of lining up a day to go to conciliation with the four of them. But now with the bill being revoked, what we would be going to conciliation with has changed. So we are basically have told the employer of our intent to go back to the start and start bargaining again and go from there. So that means that in those sectors, it will be bargaining as usual, with going through conciliation, mediation, and the right to strike if necessary. Just because I know in the last session there was a lot of questions, retroactivity, yes, we will be seeking retroactivity back to the first date that the bill applied to you or whatever bargaining unit you're in. So for the hospitals, that'll be April 1st, 2019. With the usual provisions, we would seek that people who have left would be entitled to the retro, and as we always always do in our bargaining.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Okay, members, it's now your turn to ask us some questions. I have several in the queue, but if you'd like to press star 3 to get into the queue, please go ahead now. And we're going to take our first question, which is from Chris from Local 75. Chris is asking, will this open our contract to 2019? Will ONA look at the NP scope of practice changing in the renegotiating of previous contracts? Steve, if you want to answer that.
Chris, I think that all the issues that were on the table in those past rounds, the one-year contract for the hospitals and then the two-year, we'll be looking at all of them and taking what we need to back to the table and to the arbitrator if necessary. Certainly on an ongoing going forward basis, we would be looking at the NP scope of practice issues.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Margaret at London Health Sciences Center. What will Cavaluzzo be doing as we move through this next steps if Ford does appeal the decision? Will we be pursuing further legal action against the Ford government in the next phase?
Thanks, Bernie and Margaret. I can take this one. So in terms of the appeal process, if the Ford government files a notice to appeal before the end of December, December 29th is the last day that it can do that, then it will have 30 days from then to file their record and the information that it will be relying on in its appeal. ONA would then have 60 days, so around to the end of March, to file its materials, including its legal argument and any elements of the record that it's relying on. So that is about an 80-day process that would lead to the exchange of documents. We would also then be trying to schedule a date to hear the appeal. It's not clear how long that would take. In cases of this size and profile, often there is pressure to get an expedited hearing, and we would have discussions about whether and how to do that. So that's sort of what the appeal process would look like. We would then get a date before the Court of Appeal. I expect, although we were in court for 2 weeks, at the trial level, it will be a much shorter number of days, likely, I would think, between 2 to 3 days to hear the appeal, and that would happen at some point in 2023. So that's what the appeal process would look like. I think the other part of that question is whether there would be other legal action against the Ford government. And there's a number of processes, including collective bargaining processes, that flow from the decision, and we would of course coordinate closely with ONA with respect to any other actions.
Great, thank you very much. Our next question comes from Michelle from Castle Home. Does the legal team know how much this will cost the government to appeal?
Perhaps it's Jan, and I can answer this. It's a really interesting question. So how much does an appeal cost? I mean, there's costs in a variety of ways. There's financial, but most importantly, it's political. So financially, it won't cost the government. I don't have a figure. It won't cost the government as much as it did in this first round at the court level, the first level of the Ontario Superior Court, because at the first level is when you bring in all of the evidence, the affidavits and the expert reports that Sharon was mentioning, and that it's also when the cross-examinations happen. So you don't get an opportunity to bring in new evidence without leave to the Court of Appeal, and that's a pretty high threshold to reach. But frankly, I think the most important element here is the political cost of the government appeals. And that's where I have to say ONA's campaigning, ONA's support of its bargaining teams as they're heading into bargaining is so important. Because the more you talk about the negative impact and the adverse effect that Bill 124 has had on you, and it's had on the entire healthcare system, has political consequences. And those, obviously, the next round is at the ballot box. And that's where I think the real costs of Bill 124 have to really be brought home, is in the is at the ballot box and in voting.
Thank you. We have a question from an anonymous person from Providence Care. Do you think we'll get retrospective pay since the bill has been defeated? So, Steve, you touched on
it. Well, certainly we will be seeking retroactive pay. I can't imagine that that we shouldn't get it, but, you know, never promise. But we'll be for sure looking for it.
Thank you. Question from Kelly Latimer from Health Sciences North. Which negotiating team will negotiate the reopener? Will it be the current team who negotiate the 2023 or the one that was at the table when the charter challenge was put forth? And this is about our central negotiating teams, I would imagine, from Kelly.
Kelly, I think that discussion really hasn't taken place yet. It would make sense to probably to have some involvement. Right? Well, it would make absolute sense to have involvement of the people who were there. Whether we can pull that off in a short time frame, I don't know. The negotiations group and the board will have to have more discussion with Andrea on that.
I just want to jump in. This is Danielle. Just to acknowledge that Kelly was one of the leaders who provided an affidavit that formed part of ONA's record and was particularly provided important evidence about the impact of Bill 124 on the last round of bargaining. So thank you. Thank you to Kelly.
Thank you. Michelle Beaudry, we have not had a contract under Bill 124. We are in negotiations. Can we go ahead to InterStarb without Bill 124 at this point? Steve.
Hi, Michelle. Yes. It's like it doesn't exist. Carry on.
Great. That was short and sweet. Well,
I was thinking in my head that one advantage of HSN taking so long to do the first collective agreement for that group is now they push them out past the bill being defeated. So.
Thank you. We have a question from Jennifer at Windsor Regional Hospital. It isn't related to this charter challenge. She is wondering, they have SMG training that is mandatory at home and on a home computer. She wants to know if this violates the right to disconnect. Shouldn't they do the training in the hospital? The disconnect law does not, she was informed that the disconnect law does not apply to ONA members because it's not in the collective agreement.
So it's Sharon here. Danielle has actually done an opinion for us, so I'll let Danielle take a jab at this.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Sharon and Jennifer, for the question. I can't speak to the specifics of the training that you're asking about, but in general, the law around the right to disconnect is a law that requires employers to have a policy on the expectations around connection outside of work hours. It is not actually a law that requires that provides a concrete right to disconnect. So much of the coverage and discussion in the media regarding this law has been somewhat misleading in the sense that it has framed it as more of a concrete right than the legislation actually provides. What the legislation does provide, though, is a footing for additional discussions with employers about what that right should look like and what should be in the policies where owners' collective agreements provide for consultation processes with employers for new or significantly changed policies. There are avenues there to have input into those policies, and it can also be something that members can identify as a priority in future bargaining as well.
Thank you. Tyler from Dryden, Kingston Health Sciences, he's asking, since there were comparisons to male-dominated sectors during the Bill 124 hearings, will this be used in bargaining to catch us up? Steve?
Yes, in some fashion. I don't know whether it'll form part of our discussions with the reopeners or whether it will go in with our upcoming negotiations. But some decisions have to be made about that. But certainly that's on the radar.
Thank you. Lori from the Southeast HCCSS. Now that we know there was a significant surplus, are we going to be going into the reopener asking for more than the 1.75%?
Lori, you don't really have a reopener because you're bargaining, like the HCSS they're bargaining now. But yes, our wage, what we're looking for in wages, I don't have a number, but it will be more than 1.75%.
Thanks, Steve. I don't see any questions, any further questions in the queue. I'd like to remind you that all of these questions will be compiled in a Q&A document for you and for your members should they want to access it online. So before we adjourn, I want to thank you for joining the town hall today. And I want to also to state in closing that this fight is not over if the government appeals the court decision. So I am encouraged by your response to our first poll, which was a resounding 86% of you who are willing to do political action in the event of an appeal. I know many of you are beyond angry and frustrated that you have been disrespected and devalued by this Ford government, especially after all that you have gone through and done for and during this pandemic to care for Ontarians. I encourage you to keep sending in the emails to the government to amplify your voice. Please go to ona.org/bill124 to send your message. And encourage all of your contacts to do the same. We are going to continue to demand that the Ford government not appeal the court's decision. Please watch for future emails with information about upcoming actions. If you are not receiving emails, please go online to our newest platform, Access ONA, and update your information with us. The instructions are there. I would like to also take a moment to thank our team online tonight and to those behind the scene. This win was a collaborative effort from you, our members, and from many staff. I'm going to now adjourn the town hall. Please enjoy some safe personal time this holiday season. Each and every one of you deserve that and so much more. Thank you and good night.